Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are cracking open a really fascinating stack of sources that I think fundamentally challenge how most of us think about diet.
They really do.
For years, the whole conversation has been stuck on calories, right? Calories in, calories out.
Right, the simple math.
But today, we are moving way beyond just counting calories or, you know, focusing on weight loss. We're looking at quality and source.
And that's the mission for you, our listener,
today.
It's to get a quick but really thorough understanding of how these shifts in macronutrient quality, not just the amount, fundamentally impact your metabolic health, disease prevention, and, you know, the ultimate goal, longevity.
That's the whole point, isn't it? Because you're just saturated with information, keto, plant-based, paleo.
It's claiming to be the best.
Exactly. Yeah. And people just want a clear path. They want to know what the high-quality clinical and epidemiological data actually says about long-term health.
So we're synthesizing that data. We're trying to cut through the noise and figure out what the optimal approach for resilience across the entire lifespan really looks like.
We're basically going from the grocery store aisle debate to the cellular biology of aging.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And to do that, we need a shared vocabulary because talking about proteins and lipids can get pretty abstract pretty fast.
Okay, let's do that. Let's unpack this with an analogy that the sources use, which I thought was brilliant. It makes these concepts really concrete.
Right.
Think of your body as this huge, complex, bustling city. It needs constant maintenance, it needs fuel, it needs structural integrity to keep from falling apart.
It's a perfect metaphor for metabolic function. It forces you to visualize how the body prioritizes things.
Precisely. And our macronutrients, protein, carbs, and fats, they're the construction team, the fuel delivery, and all the raw materials for the city. So let's look at the three pillars through that lens.
Okay.
First, proteins. The sources call them the engineers and the structural steel.
The builders.
The builders. They create the frameworks for all the buildings, your muscles, organs, hormones, and they keep all the vital systems running, literally rushing to repair damage the second it happens. Their main job is structure and regulation, not energy.
And that distinction is so vital. They're expensive resources, you know?
Yeah.
Prioritized for these really specialized jobs, they are not the preferred fuel.
No. Then you have carbohydrates. They're the high-octane petrol.
The immediate fuel.
The quick primary fuel source for everything the city needs to do right now. Running the cars, powering the generators. They're so efficiently converted into immediate energy.
And you have to use them pretty quickly or store them in those very limited reserves, right? Like liver glycogen.
Exactly. Which leaves fats. The sources frame these as the long-term energy reserves and the cellular membranes. So think of them like dense battery packs.
Right. Incredibly energy dense. They can power the city long after the daily petrol supply runs out.
But they also have that equally important structural role. The physical walls, the security systems, the gatekeepers around every single district, every single one of our trillions of cells.
Controlling what comes in and what goes out.
And that whole setup, that whole analogy, really highlights the biggest risk when any diet gets out of balance.
It does. It sets up that crucial trade-off. If the city runs out of petrol, the carbs or the battery power from fats.
Then the engineers, the proteins, have to reluctantly start tearing down the city's infrastructure.
They cannibalize muscle tissue for fuel.
That's the fundamental compromise we see when diets get dramatically imbalanced, either in their ratios or in their sources. It's a compelling setup.
It is.
So now let's dive into the foundational science behind these three roles so we can really judge the quality of the raw materials in all these different diets.
Let's do it.
Okay, let's start with protein, the architects. It's the macro we all associate with fitness, with building muscle, but its role is so much broader than just biceps, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Proteins from your diet, they get broken down during digestion into these crucial molecular units, amino acids. There are 20 different ones the body needs, and their functions are just extensive.
So structurally, what are we talking about?
Structurally, they're the basis for all tissue growth and repair. Muscle, skin, your vital organs, they're constantly regenerating. And amino acids are the raw material.
They're also the communicators, the accelerators.
Absolutely. They're regulatory. They synthesize hormones like insulin and growth hormone and those critical brain chemicals, the neurotransmitters that control your mood and cognition.
So they're not just building blocks.
Not at all. They also act as enzymes, starting and accelerating almost every chemical reaction in the body. They're really the operational core of the city.
And their essential status is, I mean, that's key to how we plan our diets.
It is, because out of those 20, 9 are classified as essential amino acids, or EAAs.
Yeah.
The body just, It can't make these from scratch.
You have to eat them.
You must consume them through food. And if your diet is deficient in these 9, or if you don't have enough energy from fats and carbs, the body enters that structural compromise we just talked about.
Tearing down the buildings.
Exactly. It diverts that precious, structurally necessary protein just to make energy. And if that happens for too long, it leads directly to tissue compromise.
Okay, let's move on to carbohydrates, the preferred fuel. Why is glucose the body's go-to? What makes it so special?
It's really about metabolic simplicity. Carbohydrates are the body's preferred and most readily available energy source because they break down so efficiently into glucose.
And glucose is the fuel for almost everything.
Almost every cell. And especially the brain, which relies almost exclusively on glucose under normal circumstances. The body has very limited storage for it, though, about 500 grams total, mostly as glycogen in your liver and muscles.
So that limited storage really incentivizes the body to burn it first.
It does. It burns through the petrol before it taps into the dense fat reserves.
And this is where quality starts to matter immediately, right? Simple versus complex.
Correct. That classification determines the whole metabolic demand. Simple carbs, you know, sugars, they absorb incredibly fast. They just flood the bloodstream with glucose.
Which requires that huge insulin response.
A rapid, high-intensity response to get that sugar into the cells. Complex carbs, on the other hand, starches, whole grains, legumes, they're these long molecular chains.
So they take longer to break down.
Much longer. They require enzymatic digestion over a much longer period, which gives you this slow, low, sustained energy release. That stability is a massive advantage for metabolic health.
And that brings us straight to the fiber factor. Fiber gets dismissed as just roughage, but the sources paint it as maybe the single most important part of a longevity diet.
It might be. Fiber is a complex carb, and it's found exclusively in plant foods. Its importance is just, it's multifaceted. You can break it down into soluble and insoluble.
Okay, what's the difference?
Insoluble fiber adds bulk, you know, helps with regular bowel movements. But soluble fiber is the real metabolic powerhouse. It dissolves in water and forms this gel.
And that gel physically slows down digestion.
It slows gastric emptying, which massively promotes satiety. It helps you feel full longer, which naturally helps control how many calories you eat.
And it has a direct effect on your blood chemistry, too.
It does. Soluble fiber actively binds to bile acids in the gut, which forces the liver to pull circulating cholesterol out of your blood to make more bile. So it directly lowers your blood fat and cholesterol.
Wow.
And on top of that, fiber is a prebiotic. It exclusively feeds the healthy bacteria in your gut microbiome.
So you're feeding the good guys.
You are. And that process creates beneficial short-chain fatty acids, which are critical for gut integrity, regulating inflammation, and even communicating with the brain. It's this internal cleansing and regulatory system that a typical Western diet just completely lacks.
All right, finally, let's hit fat storage and structure. We know they're the dense storage unit.
For sure. At 9 kilocalories per gram, they're the ultimate energy storage, packaged mostly as triglycerides in our fat tissue. But their structural roles are just as essential. Fats, specifically lipids like phospholipids and cholesterol, form the core structure of our cell membranes.
These membranes are so overlooked, but they're literally the barrier between life and chaos inside the cell.
They are the vital gatekeepers.
Right.
They determine how fluid a cell is, they regulate signals, they control every molecule that enters or exits the cell. Without high-quality fats, that entire system gets compromised.
And they're needed for hormones and vitamins too, right?
Yes. They're necessary precursors for hormone production, especially steroids. And they help you absorb those critical fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, E, and K. Your body literally cannot access those nutrients without enough fat in your diet.
Okay, so that summarizes the baseline. The standard framework is the acceptable macronutrient distribution range, or AMDR.
Right. For adults, this established range is carbohydrates at 45 to 65% of your total energy, total fats at 20 to 35%, and proteins at 10 to 25%.
It's the safety envelope that most health organizations agree on.
Pretty much.
But this AMDR is just a starting point, and this is where we pivot. It's all about quantity. The deep dive into your sources shows that just staying within those lines isn't enough. The quality and the source of those macros are what truly dictate your health and aging trajectory.
Exactly.
So we need to see how modern diets bend and break those rules, and if those shifts are actually justified by the quality of the ingredients.
Let's get into it.
Okay, let's unpack this comparison table. It shows how these major dietary patterns spread their macros. We have the AMDR baseline, and then these other philosophies that often deviate pretty significantly.
Right. And analyzing the data lets you see the quantitative extremes right away. You can see the different philosophies in the numbers.
So what defines the WFPB model, the plant-based model, quantitatively?
The whole food, plant-based, or WFPB, and low-fat vegan models, they sit at one extreme. They rely massively on carbohydrates, often 60 to 75% of energy, which is way past the standard midpoint.
So if carbs are that high, fat has to be low.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Fat intake gets forced down to the low end, maybe 10 to 25%. Protein stays moderate, around 10 to 15%. But the critical point in the sources is the quality focus. It's all unrefined, complex, fiber-rich carbs.
Okay, so contrast that with the default setting for so many countries, the omnivorous or Western diet.
This diet looks moderate in carbs, 40 to 55%. But the fat content is high, often hitting 30 to 40% of total energy.
And protein is higher too.
Protein runs higher, yeah, 15 to 25%. The problem isn't just the numbers though, it's the quality deficit hidden underneath them.
Meaning
a high reliance on refined carbs, very little fiber, and a substantial, almost unavoidable intake of saturated and trans fats from processed foods and animal sources.
And then we have the most radical departure from the AMDR, the high protein or ketogenic style.
This is a forced metabolic shift. Carbs get pushed down to very low, sometimes 10% or less of total energy, which is way below the AMDR floor.
So fat has to skyrocket to make up the difference.
It soars up to very high, often over 75% of energy. Protein is also usually elevated, around 20 to 30%. The whole goal is to force the body into fat-burning ketosis.
This brings us to where the rubber meets the road for chronic disease risk, the saturated fat line in the sand. Regardless of what you call the diet, where do the sources draw that line for cardiovascular safety?
The line is unambiguous. To reduce cardiovascular risk, the goal is to keep saturated fat, or SFA, consumption below 10% of your total energy.
So 10% is the ceiling.
That's the single most critical quantitative metric for preventing arterial damage.
So how did the different diets do against that benchmark in the studies?
The comparison data is pretty stark. Western and general omnivorous diets typically exceed that 10% target, sometimes by a lot.
Because of all the high-fat dairy processed meats.
Exactly. But a study that sampled various populations, including a really healthy group from Norway, found that the healthy vegan group was the only pattern that consistently met this recommendation. They reported a mean of 8% of energy from saturated fat.
A mean of 8% in a real-world setting. That really highlights how hard it is for the average person to hit that target on a normal diet, isn't it?
It is. That 2% difference between 8 and 10% represents a massive shift in where you get your food. It emphasizes that plant-centric diets, just by their nature, minimize the most harmful fat source without requiring constant painstaking tracking.
It's like a built-in safety feature.
It's an inherent cardioprotection.
Now, this overwhelming data in favor of plant-based patterns points us in a clear direction, but you introduced a really important quality caveat from the sources. The name of the diet is not enough.
That is the critical nuance. The research explicitly differentiates between healthy and unhealthy plant-based diets. They look at something called the Plant-Based Diet Index, or PDI.
And what does that show?
It shows that strict adherence to a healthful PDI-1 focused on whole foods, legumes, fruits, vegetables is strongly associated with significantly reduced mortality.
But if you try to do a plant-based diet with junk food,
the benefit disappears, or it even reverses. Adherence to an unhealthful plant-based diet, one with lots of refined grains, added sugars, chips, deep fried stuff, is paradoxically associated with an increased risk of mortality.
Wow, so the metabolic stress from the refined junk just cancels out any benefit you get from skipping meat.
Precisely. It proves that quality trumps those quantitative macro ratios every single time.
That makes the transition perfectly clear. We need to stop talking about 60% carbs and start talking about what those carbs are. Let's do a true deep dive into the quality of each macro, starting with that fiber advantage in carbohydrates.
Let's do it.
This is a section where the sources really provide a dramatically updated view. The question isn't, are carbs good or bad, but are they complex or simple, and are they packaged with fiber? So we're contrasting the WFPB high-carb philosophy with the standard Western approach.
Exactly. On the longevity path, the WFPB diet uses a high-carb load 60 to 75% of energy as a tool for health because the source material is impeccable. It's legumes, whole grains, fruits.
And the immediate massive benefit of that is the guaranteed high dietary fiber intake.
You're guaranteed, yeah. Most Western diets struggle to hit 15 grams of fiber a day. The WFPB composition often exceeds 40 grams a day, easily surpassing the recommended 25 to 38 grams.
And that level of fiber just fundamentally changes your whole metabolic environment.
It does. We mentioned soluble and insoluble fiber, but their combined impact on the body's internal timing is so important to understand.
So how does that constant supply of high-quality fiber lead to sustained health and a low glycemic load?
Well, because that plant fiber creates a physical mesh in your gut and slows gastric emptying, the absorption rate of glucose is dramatically reduced. This gives you a consistently low glycemic load.
Meaning your blood sugar stays stable, no huge spikes.
Right, which reduces the demand on your pancreas to be constantly pumping out high levels of insulin.
And avoiding that constant high insulin demand is the key to preventing the most common metabolic disorder we see today.
Absolutely. When your cells are constantly bombarded with insulin signals because of a high glycemic load from refined carbs, they eventually start to ignore the signal. That's insulin resistance.
But high-quality complex carbs do the opposite.
They fundamentally improve insulin sensitivity, preventing chronic hyperinsulinemia. And the data is just compelling. High adherence to this pattern reduces your risk of developing type 2 diabetes by nearly 50%.
You're cutting the risk of a major chronic illness in half.
Just by changing the quality of your primary fuel source.
Okay, now let's look at the metabolic implications of the opposite approach. The low-carb trade-off. This is where complex carbs are severely restricted, like down to 10% in keto protocols. We already mentioned the body shifts into making ketone bodies.
Right, that's the goal. Shifting into ketosis by burning fat. But the body is a dual fuel engine, and it still requires a small baseline amount of glucose.
For what?
Your immune system, your red blood cells, certain parts of the brain. They either prefer or absolutely require glucose to function.
So if that 10% carb intake isn't enough, or your stored glycogen is gone, what's the cost of making that essential glucose?
If glucose availability drops too low, the body initiates gluconeogenesis, literally new glucose formation.
It has to find a non-carb source.
Exactly. And its preferred source is amino acids, which means breaking down protein. If you're not eating enough protein, the body is forced to scavenge those amino acids from your structural tissues, mostly muscle.
So just to be clear on that point, is relying on gluconeogenesis just metabolically inefficient, or is there a real structural cost we need to worry about long term?
It's both. It's inefficient because converting protein to glucose is metabolically expensive, but the structural cost is greater. If you are chronically asking your muscle tissue to supply amino acids for fuel, you are promoting muscle cell breakdown.
Catabolism.
And over time, especially without resistance training, that leads to a loss of lean muscle mass, which is a huge predictor of frailty and poor longevity outcomes later in life. The analogy holds true. The city is tearing down its own steel girders for emergency power.
It just drastically raises the complexity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The high-carb, high-fiber approach makes energy delivery simple. The very low-carb approach makes it complex, requiring meticulous balancing just to keep the lights on without sacrificing muscle.
That is the exact trade-off. Simplicity and stability versus complexity and potential catabolic stress.
All right, let's pivot now to the most nuanced macro. The one responsible for the biggest, aha, moment in the data, fats.
This is where we move past the simplistic fear of fat. What's so fascinating is that the conversation has fully matured from avoid all fat to this absolute focus on the type and source of fat is everything.
We still know high total fat is a risk, though.
Yes. Excessively high total fat intake, over 35% of energy, is linked to risks. But the specific source dictates the mechanism of harm.
We have to clearly delineate this. Saturated versus unsaturated, the health divide. Let's start with the agents of harm.
The harmful fats are saturated fatty acids, or SFA, and trans fats. Saturated fats found mostly in animal products like fatty red meat, cheese, butter, and some tropical oils cause two main problems.
Okay, what are they?
First, they raise your LDL, your bad cholesterol, which contributes directly to atherosclerosis. Second, they are the primary drivers of insulin resistance through some really specific cellular mechanisms.
And the most toxic actor in that group?
Trans fats, no question. These are artificial fats found in processed baked goods, fried foods. They're structurally abnormal. They just disrupt cellular function across the board and are considered the most harmful type of fat because of their extreme pro-inflammatory and cardiovascular risks.
Which is why they're being phased out. So we minimize or exclude those. What about the protective fats?
Those are the unsaturated fats, monounsaturated or MUFAs, and polyunsaturated or PUFAs.
Where do we find those?
MUFAs are rich in olive oil, avocados, nuts. PUFAs include the essential omega-3s found in things like fatty fish, flax, walnuts, and omega-6s. They're highly beneficial. They actively reduce inflammation, improve cell membrane structure, and lower blood pressure.
And the PUFAs are essential, meaning you have to eat them.
The omega-3s and omega-6s are the only essential fatty acids. Your body can't make them.
And this quality swap is precisely why diets like the Mediterranean and WFPB work so well.
Exactly. The Mediterranean diet gets its benefit not from being low fat, but by prioritizing MUFAs from olive oil and actively replacing SFAs with them. The WFPB diet does the same thing differently, by prioritizing whole food sources of unsaturated fats, nuts, seeds, avocados, and naturally minimizing the saturated fat and cholesterol that comes packaged in animal products.
Okay, now let's get into the core mechanical insight from the sources. This needs detail because this is the fundamental why behind metabolic disease, the mechanism of harm lipotoxicity. Why does saturated fat cause insulin resistance inside the cell?
Okay, this is a complex biochemical cascade, but it provides the strongest argument against high SFA intake. When we eat excess saturated fat, our body struggles to fully oxidize or burn it all for energy.
So there are leftovers.
There are leftovers. And this incomplete processing leads to the accumulation of harmful toxic fat metabolites inside key metabolic cells, specifically your liver cells and your skeletal muscle cells. This whole process is called lipotoxicity.
What are these toxic metabolites and what do they actually do to the cell's machinery?
The two main culprits are diacylglycerol, or DAG, and ceramide. When saturated fat accumulates, DAG levels rise, and DAG acts as an immediate inhibitor. It activates a protein kinase that directly interferes with the insulin receptor's signaling cascade.
So when insulin shows up at the cell?
When insulin arrives at the cell membrane, the receptor is supposed to trigger a downstream molecule. DAG accumulation physically prevents that from happening.
So the signal is just blocked. Insulin is knocking on the door, but the lock is gummed up with DAG.
That is the perfect analogy. The signal pathway is functionally silenced. Even if your insulin levels are high, the cell cannot efficiently execute the command to open its glucose transporters.
And so glucose absorption plummets.
It decreases dramatically, which is the physiological definition of insulin resistance.
And what about the other one, ceramide?
Ceramide might be even more damaging long term. Ceramide buildup specifically targets the cell's powerhouse, the mitochondria.
Oh, that's not good.
No. Ceramide induces mitochondrial stress and even apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. It essentially causes internal structural damage, which just amplifies the whole metabolic dysfunction.
This is a level of detail that just completely shifts the understanding. Saturated fat isn't just a passive risk factor. It's an active saboteur of cellular energy processing.
It is. And the sources detail other compounding factors, too. Saturated fat-rich diets also fuel systemic inflammation, partly by changing your gut microbiome to favor bacteria that release these inflammatory endotoxins called lipopolysaccharides.
So it's a multi-pronged attack.
It really is, which is why the conclusion is so powerful. Replacing saturated fats with MUFAs and PUFAs is clinically shown to improve insulin signaling, reduce those toxic metabolites, and lower markers of metabolic harm, like hemoglobin A1C. It's a direct quality intervention that can reverse the pathology.
Okay, let's turn to protein. The discussion here moves from preventing disease to actually optimizing the machinery of aging. The sources show that for longevity, both the source of protein and the total amount are completely intertwined.
They are. And we see a distinct quantitative difference. WFPB averages 10 to 15% of energy from protein, while standard omnivorous diets run higher, 15 to 25% or even more.
And the epidemiological data gives a clear signal about the risks of that higher range, especially the plant protein advantage.
Consistently, yeah. High intake of animal protein, especially from red and processed meats, is associated with an increased risk of all-cause and cardiovascular mortality.
And the key intervention is substitution.
The key intervention the sources point to is substitution. Replacing animal protein with plant protein from legumes, nuts, seeds, whole grains, is associated with a statistically significant reduction in mortality risk.
And we know part of that is just avoiding the saturated fat and cholesterol that comes with animal products, but let's dive into the core biological reason for the plant protein advantage itself. We're talking about protein quantity and equality for longevity pathways.
This is where we get into some fascinating molecular biology. The benefit of plant protein is intrinsically linked to its favorable amino acid composition.
What does that mean exactly?
Plant proteins are naturally lower in two key signaling amino acids compared to animal proteins, methionine, or MET, and the three branched chain amino acids, or BCAAs.
Leucine, isoleucine, and valine. Why are those specific amino acids so crucial to the aging process?
These particular amino acids act as powerful nutrient sensors. When they're abundant, They signal to the body that nutrients are plentiful, which stimulates immediate growth and proliferation.
And they do that by activating specific pathways.
They strongly activate two central nutrient-sensing pathways involved in growth and aging: IGF-1, which is insulin-like growth factor 1, and MTOR, the mechanistic target of rapamycin.
So if we're constantly flooding our system with high levels of these amino acids, we're constantly telling our body, grow, 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 instead of maintain and repair.
That's exactly it. IGF-1 drives cell division and tissue growth. MTR is the master regulator of protein synthesis, and while we need these pathways active for growth in childhood or building muscle, chronic, high activation in middle age is linked to accelerating the aging process. It can potentially increase cancer risk, and it suppresses crucial cellular cleanup processes like autophagy, the mechanism where the cell removes damaged parts. Lower MET and BCAAs, typical of plant protein, provide a gentler signal, which favors maintenance over aggressive growth.
That sounds pretty definitive, but the sources provide a major caveat here. The total load matters. It suggests just choosing plant sources might not be enough if the total quantity is still high.
This is the crucial nuance that gets lost in so many dietary debates. Research explicitly compared high-protein diets like 30% of total energy and found that they showed similar increases in IGF-1, regardless of whether the protein source was animal or plant-based.
Wait, really? That is a dramatic finding. It means a high-protein vegan diet, you know, designed for maximum muscle gain, might still be activating those aging pathways just as much as a high-protein omnivorous diet.
Precisely. The key takeaway is that for optimizing longevity, you need a dual strategy. Reducing the total protein load, keeping it in that moderate 10 to 15% range, is essential alongside choosing the higher quality plant sources. It's that combination of moderation and superior quality that best downregulates those powerful IGF-1 and MTR growth signals.
Okay, before we move to the full synthesis, we have to address the counterpoint that always comes up: sarcopenia in the elderly. Since protein is so critical for muscle, and older adults lose muscle so rapidly, is this low to moderate protein philosophy still safe for them?
It absolutely is, with a slight adjustment that is very easily accommodated. The standard guidelines for younger adults are about 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day.
And for older adults?
To actively combat age-related muscle loss or sarcopenia, older adults are often advised to consume a bit more, moving to 1.0 to 1.2 grams per kilogram per day.
Is that higher need compatible with a WFPB model?
Yes. This elevated need is still easily met by a moderate total protein intake from nutrient-dense plant sources like legumes, seeds, and whole grains. For an average older adult, 1.2 grams per kilogram might still only represent 15 to 18% of total calories, which is comfortably within that healthy range.
So the WFPB approach is still optimal.
It remains the optimal delivery system because it provides the necessary protein while minimizing the inflammatory saturated fat load.
So let's tie this entire deep dive together. We've established that a balanced WFPB pattern gives you high fiber from complex carbs, extremely low saturated fat, and moderate protein with that favorable amino acid profile. How does this macrosynthesis create a strategy for long-term health and aging?
Well, it's a systemic solution. The superior macro quality of the WFPB diet systematically addresses the three fundamental drivers of age-related chronic disease. It reduces inflammation, it corrects insulin resistance by reversing lipotoxicity, and it moderates those uncontrolled cellular growth signals.
Which is why we see such profound proven longevity benefits in the large-scale data.
Exactly. The correlation is extremely strong. Studies show that greater adherence to the healthy plant-based diet index is associated with a significantly decreased risk of all-cause mortality.
What are the numbers on that?
The relative risk figures are consistently around 0.84 to 0.86, which means a 14 to 16% reduction in your risk of dying from any cause just by adopting this quality framework.
And the specific benefits for the circulatory system are massive.
They are profoundly cardioprotective. WFPB diets are shown to reduce cardiovascular disease mortality by about 19%, and this is a direct consequence of the macro quality. The low saturated fat and cholesterol minimize the inflammatory stimuli that lead to plaque buildup.
And the fiber helps scrub out the excess cholesterol.
Exactly. It keeps the city's plumbing clean, flexible, and functional for much longer.
We detailed the metabolic advantages, but what about the cellular aging markers themselves? How does this macro profile promote genomic integrity?
This takes us back to protein. That influence on the IGF-1 and mTOR pathways, combined with the incredibly rich antioxidant and micronutrient profile from whole foods, promotes fundamental cellular aging benefits.
So when growth signals are suppressed and the cellular environment is clean,
the cell's maintenance mechanisms can finally thrive. And this is evidenced by multiple studies suggesting that high adherence to this dietary pattern can actually help lengthen telomeres.
And telomeres, for our listener, are the protective caps at the end of our chromosomes. They shorten every time a cell divides, and that shortening is the classic marker of cellular aging. The idea that diet can influence their length is just extraordinary.
It suggests the WFPB pattern isn't just preventing disease, it may be actively slowing the biological clock.
This sounds like the ultimate prescriptive tool, but we have to discuss feasibility. Is this pattern genuinely appropriate and healthy for every stage of life?
When it's properly planned, yes. Major health organizations state unequivocally that vegetarian and vegan diets are appropriate for all stages of life: pregnancy, infancy, childhood, adolescence, and older adulthood. The key phrase there is intentionally planned.
What are the main planning concerns for those vulnerable early stages?
The sources highlight that while plant-based diets for kids are nutritionally sound, the planning has to be meticulous around specific micronutrients. The two major ones are vitamin D and vitamin B12 supplementation.
B12 is non-negotiable, right?
It's non-negotiable. It's not reliably available from plant sources, and it's vital for neurological development. So supplementation is a must, especially during pregnancy and childhood. Vitamin D also needs careful monitoring in any diet.
And for older adulthood, which we touched on.
For the elderly, WFPB is potentially the most important prescriptive tool. Beyond meeting those slightly higher protein needs, this pattern delivers maximum nutrient density in easily digested forms. This helps maintain cognitive function, supports bone health, and minimizes the total inflammatory load that accelerates frailty.
It's a highly protective diet.
It minimizes the caloric burden while maximizing micronutrient delivery.
Okay, let's wrap this up.
To synthesize the core message from your sources, the complexity of the optimal longevity diet, it's not about strict abstinence or, you know, avoiding food groups because of some tradition. It's about strict quality control of the whole food principle.
Meaning?
Meaning you maximize high fiber and complex carbs for metabolic stability. You minimize saturated fat to prevent lipotoxicity. You moderate your total protein load to regulate those key growth pathways like IGF-1. And you maintain mindful supplementation of B12 and D. It's the quality that drives the long-term outcome.
We started this deep dive looking for a shortcut to being well-informed, moving beyond that simplistic idea that a calorie is a calorie. And now we have a detailed evidence-based map.
We do.
We've defined the structural roles of the macros. We've compared the pitfalls of popular diets. We've identified that powerful mechanism of harm, the cellular sabotage by lipotoxicity. And we understand the benefits of balancing plant protein quality with total quantity.
Pretty comprehensive map.
But the metabolic optimization journey doesn't end here. We've established that the total quantity of protein needs to be reduced alongside the source quality to downregulate IGF-1 for longevity, especially in middle age. But here's a final thought for you.
Oh, okay.
What if the next critical nuanced step involves strategically cycling between periods of higher protein intake, say 1.6 grams per kilogram, to build maximum muscle mass in your youth, and then transitioning into periods of low protein intake later in life to actively promote that longevity and cellular cleanup? What unique challenges does that kind of planned macro cycling present to a dedicated, high-quality plant-based dietary pattern? That is the fascinating question your sources invite you to explore next. Thank you for diving deep with us.